You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends,
a Q1 Network production.
If you have dreams or you're wondering how to make a bigger impact in this world, you're home. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. I'm Deb, Mike's wife. I suggested this idea as a way to keep him busy and out of my way after he retired. So far, it's working. Thanks for listening. It's time for Mike Seminary and Friends.
Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, the place where we strive to make a difference, a positive difference, provide you something of value. Heck, from my perspective, we just want to share good stuff. I'm your host, Mike Seminary, and I'm so grateful you've joined us. A big thanks to my friend David Hansen for my theme music, Continental Drift. Search for his work, Serotonin Waters and Moon Dot Soup, on iTunes and Spotify. By the way, I appreciate your comments and guest suggestions. Keep them coming at MikeSeminary.com or Mike Seminary and Friends on Facebook. And please visit us at Apple Podcasts and leave a review. Today, I'm so honored and pleased to introduce a former two-term North Dakota governor, the 29th United States Secretary of Agriculture, one-time interim president of the University of North Dakota, guy that's just passionate about North Dakota, father, husband, my friend, Ed Schaefer. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, Ed. It's great to see you, and how are you?
I'm well. It's good to be with you, Mike. It's been a while, and here we are connected again. It's great.
I sure appreciate you taking time to join me on Mike Seminary and Friends, and it has been a while. You know, the last time we chatted in depth was when you were interim president at University of North Dakota, and I believe you were attempting to, along with the athletic directors and the basketball coaches, put together a basketball game between the University of North Dakota and NDSU in Bismarck. And I was the mayor at the time.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I remember that well because, you know, we had this rivalry between the University of North Dakota and North Dakota State University. And me being a UND alum, wanted to see some of that rivalry come to bear. And we couldn't play football anymore. NDSU didn't want to enter the arena with the UND team, I think because they were afraid to get beat. But football was off the table. So I was trying to get things going with the president at NDSU, to say, well, okay, if you don't want to play football, why don't we do basketball? And why don't we do something in the other side of the state? Because everything, you know, the sports and the UND and NDSU are all, you know, on the eastern part of the state. Let's go west. So we were trying to put this together. And I think the presidents of the two institutions had it pretty well put together and secured until the athletic directors got involved, and then the thing fell apart.
And I was excited. I remember trying to work with the city and then the manager of the, at that time called the Civic Center, and saying that, you know, this could happen. This would be a big deal. And then for a variety of reasons, it didn't. Oh, well, things happen. We move on. And now they're playing football together. And the rivalry is back. And that's good for the state of North Dakota, frankly.
That it is.
So I mentioned that you were two-term governor. You were United States Secretary of Agriculture, and I want to talk a little bit about your history to get to the present and then the future and the things that you're passionate about and your priorities. You had come from the private sector, Gold Seal. That was your first job out of college. It was a family business, very, very significant one. Ended up selling that business. What prompted you to, after being in the private sector, make that decision to get in public policy and politics?
You know, Mike, it was an interesting trail. because really business and politics are totally different animals. And business people generally don't get involved in the public arena. And that was bothering me. And I was running an international business. I was interacting with business people all over the world from these huge companies and hundreds of thousands of employees. And I'm going, you know, these people operate massive organizations. Why don't they get involved in the political arena? Our government's always a mess. You know, things don't get delivered properly. You know, everything is kind of screwy. And, you know, when I talked to them about getting involved, people would say, it doesn't work for me. The conditions are different. You can't run government like a business. There are factors involved that just don't come to play in the private sector. But I started thinking about it. I said, that's probably true. But I firmly believe that the business skills, administrative, management, budgeting, those skills are transferable. You don't have to run it the same way, but the skills that you use to run a private business certainly could be transferred to the public sector. So I had a mission to say, let's figure out a way to transfer private sector skills into the public sector and make government more efficient, less costly, less intrusive in people using those skills. The only place I could do that, Mike, was in the governor's office, the executive branch. that was the only place you could do it. And so I, being a novice and not knowing anything about politics, just said, I want to run for governor. People said, you can't do that. You have to, you know, be elected dog catcher first or something. You have to work your way up. You just can't go for the top job here. And I said, but if my mission is to transfer skill to the delivery of government, to governance, there's only one place to do that, and that's in the governor's office. So that's what prompted me to run for governor. And fortunately, I was blessed by being elected. And my wife, Nancy, and I served 8 years side by side here in the state of North Dakota, and we loved it. And we got some good thing accomplished, and it was really a blessing to serve.
I appreciate the way that you covered that, because I want to go back to when I interviewed you for my book, which has not been published, and that's the reason for this podcast. If I hadn't shared that with you, Ed, my wife encouraged me to consider having a podcast based on that book when I decided to retire, for a lot of reasons. One, so I wouldn't drive her nuts, but to take the premise of that book and push out good content and information, because that's what we learned during the process of putting that book together. And one of the things you had shared with me was that I'm a mechanic at heart. I'm equally as comfortable meeting fellow mechanics or the President of the United States. And you had also gone on to say that you've always enjoyed fixing things, taking them apart, putting them back together to make them perform and work better, or at least as well as they were originally intended to be performing. And that's really the same approach, I think, the way you just shared, for why you got into governance and public policy. You thought from your background you could make some significant improvements on, let's call it this, all these delivery systems that the recipients of those decisions that are made, either by the executive office, the legislature, et cetera, and those are the citizens. That's how I heard that. And I think you did a great job, by the way, the 8 years you were there. And when you ran, the economy of North Dakota and the budget were in tough shape. This was pre-oil. I need to remind people of that. This was pre-oil. Oil really started to impact North Dakota in a positive way. Almost the time you were finishing your second term, 2008 and 9, and then 9 going on. So you had great challenges after you were victorious in 2000. So you had to hit the ground running, leaning on that mechanic thing that's is part of your life to fix things. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it is, and it's interesting because one of the tenets that I had in the governor's office that was a guiding principle for office, the first one actually was politics gets you elected, but performance keeps you in office, and therefore the first tenet is you serve all the people all the time. Everybody, top to bottom, in and out, wide, large, small, you serve everybody all the time. And it just, if you put that in front, you know, then you're not serving your political party, you're not serving your ideologues, you're not serving, you know, certain newspaper editorials or your desire to stay in office, you're serving the people. And I think that's the most important thing. And with my growing up and with my mechanical ability, and I built my first race engine in the seventh grade before I even had a driver's license, you know, but I, the, you know, that there's a connection that you have to make with all the people, and that's in the street. It's in the businesses, it's on farms and ranches, it's in the elevators, you know, it's in the garbage collection. It's in, you know, people are honest, they're sincere, they're prayerful, they want good government, and they understand the role that government plays in their lives. And if you can't connect with them, if you don't understand them, if you don't hear them, you can't shape government to help solve people's problems and create a better life for them. If you can't hear them, if you don't see them, if you can't connect with them, you can't govern properly, in my opinion.
I have to correct something I said. It was when you were the United States Secretary of Agriculture in 2008, 2009, is when the economy of North Dakota was really starting to be blessed from the production of oil, which you didn't have the luxury of when you were governor. I should mention that when you were appointed by President Bush to be United States Secretary, it was like the first week you had a significant challenge with regards to cruelty of animals and problems with a meat processor, and that was a big deal. And you handled that masterfully, by the way. I'm going to go back to your mechanics because I recall like yesterday you were on Junkyard Wars with Rolf Sletten and that wonderful Bob Odegaard. And I when I shared with a couple of people that I'm going to have Governor Ed Schaefer on, they said, please ask about Junkyard Wars. Because that was a big deal, Ed. What prompted you guys to do that? I enjoyed that, by the way. What prompted you guys to do that?
Okay, well, so before we get into that, Mike, I want to go back to your statement about we didn't have the advantages of oil or the revenues in government.
Yes.
Two things. One, I'm reminded of a time I was visiting with a person in the Grand Canyon, and Nancy and I were out hiking the Grand Canyon, and a lady recognized us, and she came up in the parking lot and said, you know, are you Ed Schaefer? And we went through all that kind of stuff, and she said, you know, I really always appreciated you as governor, because after you left, things really started to go well. And I thought, oh yeah, okay. And then she kind of got flustered. She said, no, that's not what I meant, you know. But you know, my point is the work we did in the 90s, you know, trimming our budgets, spending priorities, increasing education and health and safety expenditures in our state, but focusing money on attracting investment in North Dakota, focusing our policy on getting the economy moving. You know, really, in 1997, when we put in a tax incentive for horizontal drilling, is where the oil extraction from the Bakken shale oil is where it came from. And we started from that point in time, we started a steady march from 1997, till today. where we have really been able to realize and capture that asset for the people of North Dakota. And it's been hugely important to our state. But anyway, back to Junkyard Wars. You know, that was one of the first reality TV shows that was on. We were on in the 2002. We filmed it in 2001. It was ran in the 2002 season. It was the number two show, popular show, whatever they call it, on the TLC, on the Learning Channel. And it was really fun. It was exciting. It was, you had 10 hours to build a contraption out of anything you could find in this junkyard you were standing in. And then at the end of the 10 hours, you had a competition with another team on what you built. And it was quite the story, but we knew that North Dakota know-how and ingenuity and farm boys growing up welding machines together to keep them running, you know, that that we could build something and be competitive. And 1,000 teams applied, 8 were selected, and we came in number 2.
It was exciting to watch, very memorable, and at times hilarious. It was it was fun to see you through a different lens, if you will. And one of the reasons I bring it up, I've had the blessing to know you fairly well. There were times we used to run together, me typically following you, because you, when you were running, you were a heck of a runner. And then we talked one time about, should we buy a radio station together? And then during part of your political career, I got to know you fairly well. And I've always felt that, well, first of all, you're a great listener. You're passionate about North Dakota. You just care deeply about people. You're incredibly approachable. And it's just a heck of a nice guy. And so those are things that I don't know that some people know about you. And then this Junkyard Wars thing just showed even a greater appreciation for us to know you about what type of guy Ed Schaefer is. I want to jump to, and there's a reason I'm doing it this way, to get to your passion and priorities today. You were the interim president at University of North Dakota back in 2016. And that, by the way, was somewhat controversial. Some people thought that, boy, you don't have that background. You really can't be the president of this institution. One thing I've always believed, Ed, is when we look at a job or a responsibility based on kind of how it's always been done, I think that narrows our ability to see the forest through the trees, if you will. And I thought you did a great job. And the fact that you didn't have that educational background, I thought served us well. And so my question is this: at any point in time, did you give consideration to being the full-time president of your alma mater?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for feeding my ego here this morning. I appreciate that. I'm going to jump for the day here now, and I'll be in good shape. But yes, Nancy and I did, when we got there, we specifically said, you know, we're going to do a 6-month stint. I had talked to some other friends that served as interim presidents, one who was in his 7th year as the interim president, and said, you know, we're talking about a time here where the university has some very specific needs. We got budget problems. We've got the students doing a no confidence letter to the president. We've got the faculty that's in an uproar. I mean, there are some specific problems to the point of where Nancy was saying, why do you want to go up there with all the problems? Why would you want to do that? And I'm going, that's why I want to go up there. That's why I want to do it, because we need to fix some things at this university. And so it was a challenge, but we committed 6 months. When we were there, it was such a wonderful experience. We both loved it. The students are invigorating. Living on campus is just the most exciting thing, interacting with learned educators, with people who are really interested in the educator process, in the administrators that are just committed like 100% to the university. We just loved it, and it was really great. But we had some other commitments, we had some other things going on, and when the presidency, full-time presidency search was going on, we just said we love it. If we would have started out this thing with a different trail here and maybe had some different commitments or whatever, it would really be interesting to stay on, because it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
So that gets us to, obviously there are plenty of more information and biographical data that we could talk about, but substantially we're kind of caught up, if you will. Today, 2021, what are your passions and your priorities? What's occupying your time, and what are the things that you're wanting to accomplish? Because you're one of those people that you always have goals, and you're driven to make a difference. What are those passions and priorities in 2021?
I've been focusing on two things, really, other things as well, including our 14 grandchildren. But, you know, it takes a fair amount of time, but, two things that are really going on that are important to me is, the Medora Foundation, the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation in Western North Dakota. I chair that board. And as you know, that was a family organization that was converted to a public foundation in 1986. So it's a public foundation, and it's the gateway to the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Provides recreation, entertainment, and education facilities and programs as people come out to visit the Theodore Roosevelt National Park and the Badlands in Western North Dakota. So that's a really significant piece. It's the largest recreational and entertainment facility in North Dakota, and in fact the region. And what's going to happen is, a year from June, I term out as the chair of the board. And it'll be the first time that a family member who grew up with Medora, who worked in Medora, will not be involved on the board of directors. So we've embarked on a project to shape the organization for the next 50 years. And we've got 50 years in, we're going to do another 50. And that included really changing around our governance structure, the committee work on the board, the way we select new members of the board, which is why I have to go off because we now have term limits. We have revamped totally the way that the organization is going to be governed and move forward to meet the needs of the traveling public in the future. The other thing that is a component of that is, how do we instill the values that are there? We feel strongly this is family entertainment in today's world, holding on to some family, good quality, nice and crude entertainment facilities. We feel that's important. So now we're going through a process of not only swapping around our governance and learning how to do that, but we're also saying, how do we identify our values? How do we articulate those values? And how do we instill those values into our team for the future? As the world starts crumbling around us, as social media takes place and people are saying anything, doing anything, wanting anything, where you cancel every word that's said, if you do, you know, those kinds of things we're dealing with in the marketplace. How do you, instead of adjusting to what the public say they want or what the world says they want, how do we maintain our values of family entertainment and family recreation and still interact and compete in the marketplace? As the world changes around us, we need to adapt to that, but I don't think we have to give up our values to be able to provide the services to the people that, that we want to. So it's quite a project to try to say, okay, the world's going that way. Things are getting pretty ugly out there in social media, but how do we maintain our dignity? How do we maintain the things we stand for? How do we have the confidence to project what we believe is right when you know somebody's going to start pounding on you on Facebook or something? Or you just have to have that confidence of who you stand for or what you are, what you stand for, and how you present, and stick to it instead of adjusting to something that might be negative or something that somebody says, well, I want a comedian that swears in the musical. And we go like, no, we don't do that. So we have to instill those values in our organization going forward. And that's been a fun project as well.
Boy, you could unpack a lot of that stuff. The first thing I want to say, thank you for doing that. Thank you for wanting to protect good, appropriate, wholesome family entertainment. There's plenty of other places people can go if that's not what their preference is. And you don't have to interfere with this. So this is all about wholesome, good family entertainment. Thank you for doing that, Ed. The other thing I found interesting is that this is a result of your family, what you're talking about, this how this started, and that you're term limited out. So I found that interesting in a world where we talk about term limits in some ways, and then we avoid term limits in another way. And here's something that started by your family and you're terming out. I just found that kind of an oxymoron almost, if you will. But
well, it's, you know,
that's
it's,
the
it's,
governance of the board that you have.
Exactly. And it came about, I, as chairman, pushed installing term limits for our board. We were looking at it, and we have a list as long as your arm of people who want to serve on the board in Medora. And we also have, a changing arena around us. So sometimes we need more input on entertainment. Sometimes we need more input on Western heritage or whatever the case may be. So you have to be able to shuffle around your board to meet the needs of the organization. And also one thing I found out in the office is the longer you're on these positions of authority and direction, the farther away you get from people. You're in a different position. People treat you differently. When I was governor, back to the car thing, when I was running for office, I could go into the service manager in an auto dealership in a town and say, hey, what are people talking about? What's up? What's ever, and get some. After I was elected, I walked in and they go, oh, geez, the governor's here, and everybody clams up. Right. So, and the longer you're in office, the farther away you get from people. And if you're going to serve the people, you got to be aware of that. So I installed the term limits on our board because I wanted to see rotation on the board. But I also felt that you needed to keep it fresh, keep younger people coming in because our audience gets younger, all of those reasons. And one thing I certainly feel strongly about is anybody in the organization plays by the rules. It's not, I'm going to stall in term limits for everybody but me. I'm going to install term limit for everyone. And when you're, if you're the governor, if you're the chair of the board, if you're the CEO or the president or the janitor, everybody ought to live by the rules and follow them, because that is the consistency of leadership that that people appreciate and allows you to move your organization forward.
You're always leading by example, Ed. So you said there were two things. That was one. What's the second?
Well, the other I'm involved in.
In terms of your passion.
Biomedicine. I got involved in, I serve on the board of directors of a biomedicine company. And it's intriguing now, the biomedicine efforts, research that are coming through that really create, especially in the cancer field, cures and proponents of healing for cancer victims that are natural, that are biological, that aren't chemical. They aren't radiation. And you can get the same effect with by putting natural cells from your body that are changed and removed and put back in and reduce tumors to grow cartilage, to, you know, whatever the case may be. There's just so much going on in biomedicine. And I think it's huge. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see, and before probably, and we're going to see incredible human advancement in medicine that is going to be natural and accepted by your body, and that will perform, cure things that medicines, radiations, and chemicals just can't do today.
How did you get involved in biomedicine?
Well, it was an interesting trail. So when I left USDA, I joined a group of people who were trying to increase beef production in China. Beef production in China was pretty limited. They were importing all their beef, and we were happy to do that from the United States. But their whole beef production in China was coming from spent milk cows, basically. And so there was a lot of black market beef coming in. There was a lot of Australian beef, a lot of U.S. beef, which we thought was great. But really, for the health and safety of the people in China, we felt that they needed to gin up their production of beef. Anyway, long story, during that process, one of the people on the team was the Microsoft director of Asia. And so I got to know him. He got a good friend, and we went through some pretty interesting times together. And, you know, it's kind of when you're in the war, you're sitting around talking in the din of the recesses of the war, so to speak. So we got to know each other real well and liked each other and worked together well in that project and stayed in touch. And he went to Alibaba. He's a Chinese naturalized USA citizen. So, but he lives in China. So we, you know, went back and forth and one thing led to another, and he left Microsoft and went to Alibaba, and then he left Alibaba and went to this cellular biomedicine company. And he called me up one day and he said, you know, I just been thinking about the way you work and the things you do and the things you stand for. And it was kind of a conversation on fetal tissue and, you know, using fetal tissue to develop stem cells and all that. And he didn't want to do that, and trying to figure out his organization as scientists, how to deal with those kind of moral issues and stuff. And he said, I'd like to talk to you about getting involved in the company and maybe serving on the board and things like that. So one thing led to another, and I was elected to the board and of a public company. And we have now taken that company private. So it's not on the NASDAQ exchange anymore, but it's a private organization that is non-revenue, but it is doing research in about 80% of cellular biomedicine and about 20% in stem cell medicine.
Well, I sure agree with you with regards to the explosive future in terms of growth regarding medical in general, but particular biomedicine. And in cancer, whenever there is an opportunity to avoid the traditional forms of treatment that are really so hard on a human being, and they're more natural based, that's going to be a huge market opportunity. Just no two ways about that. Ed, I want to ask you about what I think we probably share in common as we observe the political landscape of today. I try to avoid partisan politics on my podcast, so I won't reference that. But it sure appears to me, since you mentioned the cancel culture, we're in some real difficult times. It's almost like, first of all, the art of statesmanship is gone. It just seems like there is this nonstop attack on someone that has a different perspective or a different belief or a different approach, number one. Number two, the other thing I think I'm seeing is people are getting awfully creative, finding ways to develop programs or departments that need funding, which is another way of being really creative at finding ways to confiscate money from other folks. And that's across party lines. It just appears to me that we're at a point where we can't find enough ways to spend money fast enough, while we also argue about some of the most basic ways for us to accomplish things productively and healthy and move forward. Am I wrong on all of that?
No, I think you're right. And what's happened, Mike, is we have become this society of anger and disappointment. And I think part of the problem is government doesn't do anything. Republicans elect Republicans to go to Washington and fix problems. They don't. Democrats elect Democrats to go to Washington and fix problems. They don't. They get caught up in the system. They get more focused on getting reelected than serving. You get all this stuff going on. And if you think of it, so as it's become more partisan, as we focused on it, what happens? So the Obamacare, for instance, was passed without one Republican vote. In the Democrat administration, it was pushed through by Senator Kent Conrad in North Dakota, and a reconciliation in the middle of the night. So it wasn't even voted on. And it was put out as public policy for the United States of America. The problem with that is if you don't craft public policy by getting all input, it's not acceptable. So instead of having Social Security, for instance, that was a bipartisan policy put forward and acceptable in the marketplace or acceptable amongst the people because it was bipartisan. You have Obamacare that's never been accepted, that gets thrown in the courts all the time, that's always pushed into the Supreme Court. Is it there? Because it was only one side. And what we have forgotten is our founding fathers were genius in saying a representative form of government is for you to elect somebody from Main Street in your community, somebody that you trust, somebody that you know, and somebody that, you know, your barber or your minister or your school teacher, you send them off to the governing body and they are going to collect the information and use their judgments, which you trust, to craft public policy. Public discourse, both sides are right. One of the things that when I ran for office, I had to decide whether I was a Republican or a Democrat because I didn't know. I thought maybe I was just should be a Democrat because my parents were Republicans. So I had to figure that all out. But you know, the thing I learned though as I studied both is that both of them are right. Both of them have both parties and other parties have honest, pure reasons for what they believe in. They often have good solutions that just seem unacceptable to the other side. But in reality, as you get into public discourse about two opposing issues, good statesmen, if you will, good public servants ought to craft public policy by taking the good pieces out of each side. And for instance, one of the tenets of a Democrat Party is short term, fix the problem, get it done. If it creates another problem down the future, we'll fix that. One of the tenets of the Republican Party is long term. We're going to look at long term solutions to this, work into them, get there. At times, one of those is needed more than the other. At times, you got to have a short-term fix quick. At other times, you can have the luxury of a long-term solution. So unless you have those debates, and unless your public servants, your legislators, your members of Congress listen to those debates and craft policy based on what is needed to serve the people at this point in time, that is the problem we have today. We don't do that. So it's all one-sided. It's all who's going to win today. Lawmakers get up in the morning and say, I'm going to cut the legs out of him or her. I'm going to win on this one. They're dead. They're wrong. They're bad. And we don't have this effort or this willingness to judge either side and craft policy that's going to include both. So when you don't do that, you separate people, you push them into one side or the other, you antagonize them against each other by saying, you know, if you want to do better, you have to shoot down that guy. Pardon my language, I'll probably get canceled all over the place, you know, for talking using these terms. But, you know, really, I mean, it's good guy versus bad guy. And you're lining up people on each side of that fence. And it's a problem. It's a mistake. People don't trust their government. They don't like their government. They're angry. They're difficult. And they're taking it out on one another. And it's a bad situation that we're in today.
So the key word almost in the middle of what you just shared was serve. I don't know that enough people that we elect really serve us. But that's my opinion. You know, the other thing I want to ask you about, Ed, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say one of the policies that I've tried to push with other governors and on a national basis is the twofold prongs of politics. The politics of politics get you elected. The politics of performance keep you there. And you have to change. When you get elected, you have to shift. Because if you're constantly trying to get elected, you don't serve well. If you're voting, if you're crafting, if you're putting words together just to get reelected, you're not listening to the people. You're serving yourself. You're not serving the people. So politics of politics get you there. But man, once you're elected, you have to shift to service because that's the problem we have today, too. People want to get reelected, so they craft their messaging. They do their votes. They do whatever. Not as what's best for the people, what's good for the people. They just do it to get reelected. So I'm a term limits guy, but I just think it's pushed us into a corner of this angst in our communities, in our society. That's a problem today when people are just afraid to talk to each other.
I agree with you. I think term limits are a partial solution. There's more to solve than just term limits, but I won't go there for now. Ed, when you won your first term, 1992, served until 2000 as governor, it was, I don't think Facebook and Twitter existed at the time. I think that was somewhere around 2004 or 5 for Facebook and a couple years later for Twitter. And then it takes you a couple years to build something significant. And now they're both huge, of course. Here's another thing I think has created great challenges for good, healthy, robust debate and conversation between parties or individuals that have a different perspective. When I grew up, there were three TV networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and then public. And you had 30 minutes at the 5:30 or 6 o'clock, whatever it was, to do your national news broadcast. You had 30 minutes for the local. Well, eventually we had the creation of cable news, and it became 24/7 and multiple options for cable news. And then we introduced in 2004, 5, 6, whatever it was, big tech communication, Facebook, Twitter, and others. And along the way, it became a platform to say whatever you want. even if you're a reporter, if you're a reporter, sometimes you use your own social media to promote you, not so much where you work. And all of a sudden, there was this battle. And what was real news anymore was very difficult for someone to ascertain what that was accurate or not. And I think that combination, while it's a free country and so on and so forth, and the tech can be very, very helpful, I think it's created this three-headed monster that has probably presented more challenges than we even know how to do. I mean, for example, today Facebook, whether you like or dislike Donald Trump, the fact that they've decided that they're going to continue to ban him, that's offsetting and off-putting for me, and I'm concerned that how does this help us get back to where we should and have good disagreement, but at the end of the day, come to solution that's best for everybody? How do we do it now, Ed?
Yeah, and I think one of the issues that we see out there is, as I look at it, and maybe an analogy, is we used to pick a fighter and send that fighter into the boxing ring and say, you box for us, and I want you to win. Now, we're all in the ring boxing for ourselves. And that's where we're grabbing information, true or not true. We pick things that we think fit within our political philosophy or direction. And we go out there and duke it out with someone in the supermarket. You know, it just is, we've taken it into this public arena that is a particular problem. And what I believe is the answer comes in the community. I think what we need to do is get back, and I'm working on a project here in Fargo, where I live, with one of the churches, about saying, how do you get back to values in the community? So if I look at some of these fights, if I look at, say, a fight on food stamps or something, really, if you break it all down, the opponents on each side have a value of wanting to take care of people, of helping people in need or whatever. Now, they might look at it differently, but really in the end, or the very beginning, the first thing is people have common values of caring for others. They have common values of raising their families, of having honesty in the marketplace, in the community, those kinds of things. So I think what we're trying to do, what we need to do, is we need to go back into the community, have public discussions, not about right or wrong, not about Republicans or Democrats, or not about you're bad and I'm good. We have to have discussions in the community about what are your values? What do you stand for? What do you believe in? What do you think is important for raising your family in this community? Those values, and certainly not everybody's going to have the same values, but when you're discussing values, you can craft direction. You can craft society based on values, not on good and bad and ugly. And I think that's where we need to go, discuss values, understanding values. And if I know values and I have a common value in the community of goodness, you know, I think you shape public policy much better.
I'm going to ask you this question. I was actually going to wait a little bit, but since you just talked about values, if you had a magic wand, you could wave over the heads of any individual or groups of Americans who have beliefs that are polar opposite to their neighbors, their friends, even some of their own family members. They have just a polar opposite perspective on life. What's the one thing you'd want them to know?
Well, this is normally when you tap dance a little bit and talk about the weather and say, that was a really good question. So it gives you a chance to think, right? I think, first of all, I come at it, Mike, from my faith perspective and belief in God, and that God created all of us in his image. And he created all of us as an image so that we're not male or female, we're not good or bad, we're not big or small, we're not smart or dumb. We're all created in his image. And if we're all created in his image for love and by love, that means we have to respond to that and love our neighbor, as we're told to do. So even though somebody might disagree with me, even though I might totally disagree with a member of my family, the reality is that people come to their conclusions. They come to their beliefs honestly, in a caring way, prayerfully, studiously. They get there, and that's what they believe. I might believe something different, but that doesn't mean they're wrong. And if I can learn to understand that whatever got them to this place is honest and true for them, then I can deal with not you're wrong and I'm right, not you're bad and I'm good, but I can deal with it to say what's best for the community, what's best for your family, what's best for you personally. And you get away from this attack into saying, okay, I get it. I understand, you know, the old Native American, ready to walk a mile in your moccasins, you know, understand somebody else. You know that they're honest in their opinion. Accept that honesty, even though it might be different, and use that to help as saying, okay, what do we do for the greater good?
Well, man, I think I agree 100% with what you just said. Okay, a follow-up question. Same magic wand, and now you get to wave it over the heads of policymakers. At any level, it doesn't really matter. People that are responsible for the budgets that we have to work for with in our states, our cities, our country, and then policy about how, you know, things are supposed to work for us in the country. What's the one thing you want them to know?
Well, I think... do I have to limit myself to one?
No, go for it.
Well, if I get the chance to wave the magic wand, I got a lot of stuff to do here. what I think is important is if we could wave that magic wand and get lawmakers, policymakers, to understand a couple of things. One is there's never enough. We're never going to have enough money. We're never going to have enough resources. We're never going to have enough public employees. We're never going to have enough to do what you need to do, which means, guess what? Independence. It means freedom. It means we need to craft public policy so that people self-generate their morals and character, so that they operate within the neighborhoods in a good and timely and honest manner, and that you move the society forward not by government, but you move society forward by embracing independence and people's self-generating of their lifestyle that's in a good and positive way. So I think you need to recognize that. Secondly, I think it's important to say all of your desires and efforts here are honest, but if you can't do it all, let's focus on the priorities. What are the important things for government for us? Education, health, safety of our people. Those are the priorities. So let's concentrate on those. Let's put the resources in those. And if we do that right, set people free to work with those bases in the community so that individual members of our society are really generating the economy, that are moving our society forward, our culture forward. It's based on education and health and safety. So that means all this other stuff that government does maybe isn't necessary. Free the people, charge the people to go forward, let them go forward. Teddy Roosevelt always said, if I want to get something done, you put the right people on the team. I don't think he used the word team, but you get the right people on board. You tell them what you want to do, and you stand out of their way and let them do it. And that's what we need in our society. And I think it comes, and I can give you an example. So when I was at USDA, we were responsible for the food stamp program, of course, or the SNAP program, as it's called now. So when we got to looking at it, saying it's unaffordable, we're putting way too much money into it. We're not getting money to the people who really need, not getting enough money to the people who need it, and we're getting money to the people who don't need it, and the whole thing's kind of screwy. So when you first start talking about trying to fix it, what happens? Everybody says, well, you don't want to throw people out in the street, and you're a bad guy, and if you want to try to solve this issue, all you want to do is throw people off the rolls. And so, but if you approach it this way, and say, maybe there are three categories to food stamps. There are people who have health issues or physical problems or birth issues or mental capacities or things like that that are always going to need help. They're always going to need our society, our people, and our government through our people to help take care of. And that's a very important piece, and that's a focus of what the food stamps ought to be. There's another element of food stamp recipients, and those are people that somehow are there not because they want to be, but they've been kind of forced into it. A divorced mom who never got a degree, dropped out of high school and had a kid or something like that. They're a guy who got PTSD, someplace and can't find a job. There are people in that, for whatever reasons, have a lack of training, have a lack of skill, have a lack of education that doesn't allow them to perform in a job. Those people we need to socialize. Those people we need to put programs together and say, here's how we're going to educate you. Here's how we're going to get your skills. Here's how we're going to get you transportation to go to work. Whatever the case may be, we're going to get you to work. So they go off the rolls, they go to work. And the third people are those who just historically are on the rolls. They've just always been there. That's all they know. They're capable. They can work. They can get out there and make the way for themselves if they just don't have the motivation to do so. In my opinion, they need to go off the rolls right away. So if you look at it in three categories, you take care of the people that you need to. You train and educate the people that you can get into society and move them off. And then the third people, you just say, you're not going to do that anymore. You have to make your own way in society. So I think if you approach things like that and say, what are the priorities? You don't have to throw people out in the street because they don't have government services. Shape government services to solve the issues that they have in their life. In some cases, you're always going to have government services. In some cases, you need some government services to move you off. And in other cases, you need the incentive to say you're off. So I just think over and over and over again, I see that in government, that if we would look at priorities, if we'd look at saying this is how we can shape our government in a way that's affordable and is directable to people, I think there's tons of stuff that we can do. In doing in North Dakota, by approaching our government that way in North Dakota, priorities and using government to shape the culture out there, we lowered the cost of government in the state of North Dakota in 8 years, and something that's never been done. So you can do it. You can do it. And by the same time as we lowered the cost of government for our people, we increased the expenditures in education, health, and safety. So, in my opinion, those examples ought to be transferred all over the place and used for the betterment of people.
When do I get to vote for you again?
Jesus.
That was just great.
I think I'm way over the hill for that stuff, man.
Well, last question. This is totally off of all the subject matter we've just talked about. Mother's Day is around the corner. now that we're starting to have some, you know, freedom again, are you going to have any of the grandkids or kids around for Mother's Day? Are you going to go somewhere?
You know, we aren't, unfortunately. We're Zooming, as been our habit. In this last year, we had two graduations, a baptism and a wedding via Zoom with grandkids. But I tell you, one thing that's just so intriguing is about, I think it was an hour after Nancy had her first virus vaccination, she started talking about seeing the grandkids. You know, it's like, it's been a year and a half, we haven't seen our grandkids. And all of a sudden, it was just this flood of emotion of saying, I've been holding in, I can't stand it anymore. You know, I now have my vaccination, I'm going to get my next one, I'm going to go through the two-week incubating period or whatever it is, and I'm getting on the trail to see my grandkids. So we did, and that's really the way it is for all of us. I mean, we're getting our vaccinations, we're getting out of the cave, we're opening up into society, we're getting back into neighborhoods, we're visiting with people again, and that's exciting. And so I obviously urge everybody to get their vaccinations so that we can provide health and safe arena out there for us to engage in our community. But at this point in time, this Sunday coming up for Mother's Day, we're going to be Zooming, but I'll make sure that Nancy has a great Mother's Day, even when all the grandkids are in absentia.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to join me. Thank you for your years of leadership and service and the continued investment that you make in our state and all of us. Appreciate you and Nancy for all that you're doing. You've been just a blessing to all of us, and appreciate you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Mike. It's fun to be on the podcast, and I hope maybe my words out there help work a little bit to heal things in the communities and get people back together again.
Amen. Hey, God bless you, Ed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. You are profoundly appreciated. Where would I be without the team at Q1 Network? Anna DeVere, Ashley Harris, Bo Hastings, and Marlo Anderson. And my wife, Deb. Deb really orchestrates all of this for me. I have an incredible wife, partner, and friend. Thanks again for listening to Mike Seminary and Friends. Until we chat again, love y'all.